What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Randy Schoenberg, the attorney who won the Woman in Gold legal case to restore Gustav Klimt's great painting to the Jewish heirs of the family from whom the Nazis stole that artwork. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This past week was a secular anniversary of the reunification of the old city of Jerusalem, known as Yom Yerushalayim in Israel. We marked 48 years since the Six-Day War ended, with Israeli troops universally triumphant over the armies of Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, smaller contingents from Lebanon and Iraq, as well as military and logistical support from Algeria, Kuwait, Libya, Morocco, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Tunisia, and of course the Palestinians. It is hard to believe that it has been nearly half a century since the then unbelievable, miraculous triumph of the Israelis, a victory that was not predicted by, well, pretty much anyone prior to the war. That short war, June 5th to 10th, 1967, changed the map and the balance of power in the Middle East dramatically. The area under Israeli control tripled, significantly contributing to the country's defensibility, as would be demonstrated in the subsequent Yom Kippur War. Although Israeli morale and international prestige were greatly increased by the outcome of the war, the resulting displacement of civilian populations had long-term consequences. Something on the order of 300,000 Palestinians fled from the West Bank. Jews everywhere in the world walked taller and stood straighter after the Six-Day War, and Israel became a magnet for tourism and immigration. The shocking and total Israeli victory created a new reality, one that the Arab world has been working ever since to deny or reverse, essentially without success. In September of 1967, the Khartoum Arab Summit resolved there would be no peace, no recognition, and no negotiation with Israel. But even in that, there was a kind of surrender. No longer was the Arab world focused on eliminating Israel. Now it turned to questions of borders and boycotts, arguing about refugees and Palestinian organizations rather than the necessity to eliminate the Zionist state. Although lessons learned by the Egyptians and Syrians led to the bloody Yom Kippur War just 6 years later, that too failed to destroy Israel, and it ended with the Jewish state as the unquestioned military leader in the region. Wars continued to be fought, but increasingly they would be conducted in the neighboring Arab states, Lebanon or Syria, and in parts of the captured territories like Gaza or Sinai. The Six-Day War changed everything. And it is somewhat astonishing that nearly 50 years after its conclusion, large parts of the world continue to pretend that Israel didn't win a defensive war and that Jerusalem's status should somehow be in dispute. It's as if Britain had continued to claim that New York, Boston, and Philadelphia should still belong to it through the middle of the 19th century. Somehow, the effort to pretend that land that was officially controlled by Egypt, Jordan, and Syria for less than 20 years and has been Israeli for 48 years now was always some mythical Palestinian nation that has never actually existed. Well, that thought has persisted. It's now spread into Europe and onto American college campuses. It is so odd, so persistently astonishing. One photo from the Six-Day War typifies the extraordinary magic the Jews everywhere felt with that victory. That legendary picture shows three men walking in the old city not far from the Jaffa Gate. Two of them were famous even then, and are still so now. Moshe Dayan, the eye-patched Israeli defense minister during the Six-Day War, and Yitzhak Rabin, the chief of staff of the IDF during that Six-Day War, and later Israeli Prime Minister and Nobel Peace Prize winner and martyr of the effort for peace with the Palestinians.
ושל נחושת ושל אור, הלא לכל שירייך אני כינור, ירושלים של זהב ושל נחושת ושל אור, הלא
The third man in that old City of Jerusalem photo from June of 1967 with Moshe Dayan and Yitzhak Rabin is not so well known, but his story is extraordinary. His name was Uzi Narkis. He commanded the Israeli troops who actually captured the old city. Narkis was born in Jerusalem to Polish Jewish parents. His first memory was of going into hiding during the 1929 Arab riots that slaughtered so many Jews in pre-state Palestine. Uzi Narkis attended the famous high school at Gymnasia Rachavia, joined the elite Palmach secret unit at the age of 16, and was involved in Haganah operations against British mandatory forces in Palestine. In April 1948, Narkis headed the assault on Katamon, captured the monastery at San Simon, a key strategic position in the War of Independence. Following the final departure of the British and the Israeli Declaration of Independence, Uzi Narkis was appointed to help those besieged in the Jewish quarter of the old city. Narkis' unit succeeded in penetrating through Zion Gate. You can still see bullet holes in the walls there, bringing in supplies and evacuating the wounded from those under siege. When military reinforcements failed to appear from the Israeli side, however, Narkis was forced to order his men to retreat. The old city fell to the Jordanian forces shortly thereafter. The Jordanians destroyed every single Jewish building in the old city immediately. Uzi Narkis spent several years in France during the formative years of the State of Israel, studied at the École de Guerre, the French military academy, and later served in France in the capacity of Israeli military attaché. He was awarded the Legion of Honor by the French government and then returned to Israel to continue his military career. In 1965, he became the first director of Israel's National Defense College, Israel's version of West Point. In June of 67, Narkis had seven brigades under his command. He was responsible for stopping any possible Jordanian offensive. Capturing the old city of Jerusalem was not in the plans. Israeli units moved effectively. They took key positions in East Jerusalem. One central location was Ammunition Hill, taken in a hard fight with many casualties. Still, to Narkis' dismay, the politicians did not allow the old city to be captured. But with a ceasefire looming after an emergency meeting at the UN, Moshe Dayan finally gave the order to Uzi Narkis. He quickly capitalized on the opportunity to reunite the city before a ceasefire prevented it. Under Narkis' direction and using only small arms fire, no artillery, no airstrikes to protect the monuments and sacred sites, the old city of Jerusalem was taken and Yerushalayim reunified under Israeli control. From Narkis' standpoint, the liberation completed a campaign he had started 19 years earlier and whose previous failure had haunted him. Narkis retired from the army in 1968 and later held key positions in the Jewish Agency and the World Zionist Organization. You know, there's a great story that typifies the challenges in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 1948, Commander Uzi Narkis found Palestinian Commander Abdul Qadir Husseini's Quran lying on the battlefield during the War of Independence. In the 1980s, Narkis wanted to give the Quran back to Qadir's son, the Palestinian leader Faisal Husseini. Husseini, however, refused to receive it from the hands of an Israeli general. And so, that Quran remains in Israeli possession today. Sad. To play us in this morning, on the theme of Jerusalem, here's Orthodox Jewish hip-hop reggae star Matis Yahu, a past guest of Two Jewish, singing his song Jerusalem, based on the psalm in the Hebrew Bible.
In the ancient days, we will return with no delay, picking up the bounty and our swells on our way. We've been traveling from state to state, and them don't understand what they say. 3,000 years with no place to be, them want us to give up our milk and honey. Don't you see, not about the land or the sea, not the country, but the dwelling of His Majesty. Jerusalem, if they forget you,
Jerusalem, his mind forget you. Let my right hand forget what it's about. Send a people a temple and a crown of glory. Years gone by, about 60, we were burning the oven in the sanctuary. And I gas tried to talk, but they couldn't choke me. We not lie down, and we not fall asleep. So them come overseas, getting trying to be free. Erase the demons out of your memory. Change your name and your identity. Afraid of the past and a dark history. Why is everybody always chasing me? Cut off the roots from your family tree. Don't you see, that's not the way to be. Jerusalem, live by forget you. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from me tongue. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right.
That was Matis Yahu singing Jerusalem. When we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Randy Schoenberg, the attorney who won the legal case against Austria that resulted in the return of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, The Woman in Gold, which was stolen from its Jewish owners by the Nazis. His story is fascinating, and it resulted in the wonderful film The Woman of Gold that's playing in theaters right now. Find out how it all really happened when we meet him in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through 8th grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Randy Schoenberg is the attorney who led the remarkable case that has been dramatized in the recent The Woman in Gold film. I think it's a great film, by the way. He led this eight-year struggle to recover the artwork that had been in the family of his client, and in a way in his family as well, and had been stolen by the Nazis, and it began a whole new period in art restitution and in the return of art to the Jewish descendants of those who had held it before the war. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
Thank you for doing this. And how does it feel to watch 8 years of work boil down to less than 2 hours of screen time?
Well, it's not just 8 years of work. They cover 100 years of history in 100 minutes. So it's obviously condensed quite a bit. But you know what I like about the film is they have these scenes that they've created, and sometimes they've combined things together. But it's all has sort of a core of truth. So every time I watch it, I can appreciate it as a film and also think about the real things that actually happened that underlie everything.
So what did they miss in the film, I have to ask?
Oh, I mean, just a million things are not in the film because, again, it's 100 years of history. Just to give you one example, Marie and Fritz have this very dramatic escape from Vienna, and which, you know, seems like it's over-dramatized, but really, in a way, it's not even dramatized enough because they don't show that Fritz spent 2 months in Dachau in a concentration camp and was ransomed out by his older brother Bernard, who had fled, and Maria had to be flown with the Gestapo up to Berlin with some agent of Maria's brother-in-law to sign documents and things like that, and they were brought back to Vienna. Fritz was released, and they were held under house arrest. They made three attempts to escape before finally, on the fourth time, succeeding. And then the escape, you just see them leaving Vienna, but you don't see how they went to North Germany, and they had to find someone to help them cross the border through barbed wire and escape the Dutch guards who would have sent them back and that type of thing. So there's really a whole movie you could have made just about their escape, and you know, obviously they had to cover a lot of other ground.
You know, they also dramatized you with Ryan Reynolds, who has played all kinds of romantic leading men, and I'm just wondering, that's very flattering, isn't it?
Well, your audience can't see me over the radio, but no one looks at me and says, oh, there's Ryan Reynolds. He's definitely a different body type, put it that way. And but it's, yeah, of course, it's very flattering to have someone so admired. I think he was People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive or something in 2010. To have him play me is obviously great. And Katie Holmes plays my wife, but I have to say my wife is prettier than Katie Holmes.
Oh, you did very well. We are sure to cut that little excerpt and send it, email it to her as soon as possible. We will return in just a few moments on To Jewish with Randy Schoenberg, who may not be the sexiest man alive, but he is the attorney who won a remarkable verdict against Austria, and we'll talk more about art restitution when we come back on To Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on To Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. We welcome our Mivi Na'an Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Abay.
So, a week ago, nobody in America had heard of the term orange or partner or knew anything much about cell phone service in Israel, except that all Israelis are always on their cell phones all the time, even more than Americans, and have been for years. Now it's a huge controversy because of the French telecommunications company. But you knew all about Orange.
Oh, yeah. Orange is one of the three biggest telecom companies in Israel. And actually, I think at least for the last decade, if not more. And yeah.
So they have now decided that maybe they don't want to continue this 10-year contract they had with Partner to sell service in Israel. This is at a time of rising anti-Semitism in France. It doesn't smell good. It doesn't taste good. What would the Israeli reaction be? They have a contract, don't they?
Yeah, first of all, in terms of, they have a contract, but it's more than, I think, on the average Israeli, I would say, it's more than the contract itself. It smells very, very bad, because right now in Israel, and I know that also here on campuses, the BDS movement, it's really, really something that we are concerned, the Jewish people here, but also in Israel, because I'm also watching the Israeli TV, and from that and at least once a week there is a big article about like the BDS and really on people in Israel will say this is one of the strategic threat on Israel, not because it won't affect the economy of Israel. Won't, but it's the delegitimization of Israel. It's really, really legamre demonizing Israel. So I think it came in the middle of, you know, of part of, you know, a biased campaign against Israel. And then the CEO of this company just said that he doesn't want to do business. And the next day he apologized, but it was too late and too little, too late.
Too little, too late. Now he's going to Israel and he's making a big campaign about how he didn't really mean it. But is this...
So maybe at the end it will be me'az yetzah matok, but I don't know. Let's see.
Maybe good will come of bad idiomatically. But the other piece that it makes you wonder...
Oh, maybe they wanted a free publicity.
They got a lot of publicity, but it can't be good publicity in Israel. Maybe they got good publicity in the Arab world for doing this. The troubling sign is the BDS movement has had very few actual economic successes, but it's embarrassed Israel a lot of times, and Israel's supporters have seen it as clearly anti-Semitic. This actually would have some economic impact, although there's certainly plenty of telecom providers out there. And I think the scary part is this like the drop in the bucket or is this just the first step in a much larger corporate effort to delegitimize Israel?
I don't believe that it will really affect. I think at the end of the day, they will find a way to, solve the, I think there is lose situation. It's not a win-win. So they will...
They'll get out of it.
Yeah. And I don't think that it will affect other companies. At least I don't. I hope.
I hope not, too. I should note that you're wearing an orange blouse today, so it hasn't ruined everything orange. Thanks very much, Ashrod. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You have just come back from Israel, which you don't usually talk about, but now you kind of wanna. Let's talk about some of the interesting issues going on a social level and societal level in Israel.
Right. Well, Israel is characterized and conceives of itself as a Jewish state, and there's never been clear consensus or any sort of legal act or document in Israel to define what it means to be a Jewish state. And I think that I saw examples on multiple levels of ways of being a Jewish state and reflecting traditional Jewish values, and also ways of failing to do that. So it was a very interesting trip. And the first place I want to start is a wonderful institution in Jerusalem. It's been studied by social workers and mental health workers and medical people from all over the world. Delegations come like at least once a week to visit this place. It's called Melabev. And what it is basically is like a community center for elderly people with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, and with different degrees of Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. So the place casts itself as sort of a club where these people come and spend a half day or a day, 5 days a week or 3 days a week or 1 day a week, whatever they want. and they're brought there by usually their personal caretakers, whoever that might be, a friend or family. We'll come to that in a minute. But they are divided by the professional staff into like three levels of functioning. Very highly functioning people who might occasionally have trouble remembering to take a medication or something, but who otherwise can function in the same way that you and I can, sort of mid-level and lower level. And for the lower level people, they're kind of arts and crafts and music and dancing, not a lot of verbal stuff. For the highest level, there are intellectual offerings, guest lecturers, guest speakers, of which I was one. And just as an example of how sort of caring and respectful of the elderly Israel is as a society, this whole institution exists only for people whose mother tongue was English. So they're immigrants, they're elderly. They're a subset of elderly immigrants in two senses. One, they have dementia or Alzheimer's or something to one degree or another. And two, they all speak English, whether they're from Australia or England or Canada or the U.S. That's their native tongue. So I gave a talk about my context with the Taliban and Islamic extremism in general. And the questions I got were amazing. They were high-level questions reflecting the very sophisticated backgrounds and professional histories of many of these people who aren't patients but kind of club members. And I was highly impressed by the whole setup and the whole system of values that it represented. But the other thing that impressed me, and we can talk more about this next time, is that the personal caretakers of virtually every club member, every person who spent the day there, were either Thai or Filipino guest workers. And that has become a significantly growing portion of the Israeli population.
Fascinating subject, a different one. Boy, that what a great institution, and not one that I've seen anywhere in the United States. Maybe something we can learn.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The new rabbi was in the middle of a sermon when he suddenly beckoned an usher to come over. The rabbi said to him, "That guy in the third row is asleep. Wake him up." The usher replied, "You put him to sleep, you wake him up." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. This week, our Torah portion of Korach features drama and tragedy, rebellion and punishment. To recap last week's events, the people of Israel have come to the borders of the Promised Land just 2 years after leaving Egyptian slavery. But a team of spies returns with a poor report. "We aren't strong enough to conquer the land." Shocked, the Israelites rebel against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. The rebellion fails, and a verdict is proclaimed. A lack of faith in God lies at the heart of the problem, and God decides that this generation can never come into the Holy Land. We'll have to live in the Sinai for 38 more years until they are all gone, and a new generation, fresh with the optimism of youth, untainted by slavery and that mentality, can come forward. Stung by this sentence of death in the desert, at the start of this week's portion, a group of rebels under the leadership of a priest, a Levite named Korach, challenged the control of Moses and Aaron. Korach accuses them of hubris, of overweening pride and egotism, chutzpah. Born into the same tribe, Korach is an insider, rebelling against his own. "Who are these guys, Moses and Aaron, to take on the authority of ruling over us?" he asks. His rebellion threatens the very foundations of the Israelites' leadership. For if the God of liberation is not at the heart of this enterprise, if it's all a matter of personal ego and self-aggrandizement, then they might as well go back to Egypt and live in slavery, as some propose now to do.
but Korach dissembles. That is, he lies. For Moses clearly has had no great desire for his high office, has held it instead as a sacred trust given him by God. Korach threatens God's authority, not Moses. Our Torah portion tells us that in order to determine the ongoing leadership of Israel, a great outdoor contest is held, a kind of religious challenge match. The net result is that Korach and his followers are completely destroyed. Moses and Aaron are fully vindicated. It's nice when God has your back. One lesson of Korach is that before we accuse others of arrogance, we need to look in the mirror. But the even more abiding lesson is that a Judaism that doesn't base itself in humility and reverence for God, which is focused on personal aggrandizement, will fail. Only through faith and devotion will we reach our own promised land. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Randy Schoenberg, the attorney in the story in the current film The Woman in Gold, a pioneer in getting art stolen by the Nazis back to the families of its Jewish owners, and a leading figure in art restitution in general, will tell us the difference between reality and a two-hour film. That film tells the story of recovering the masterpiece by Gustav Klimt for its Jewish heirs from the government of Austria. Find out how it really happened when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a victory for narrow legalism over reality, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a disputed law last week that allowed Americans born in Jerusalem to list their birthplace as Israel on their U.S. passports. The ruling underscores the president's nearly sole authority in foreign affairs. The court ruled 6-3 that Congress overstepped its bounds when it approved the law in 2002, would have forced the State Department to alter its long-standing policy of not listing Israel as a birthplace for Jerusalem-born Americans. That policy is part of the government's refusal to recognize any nation's sovereignty over Jerusalem until after Israelis and Palestinians resolve its status through negotiations. Policy happens to ignore the fact that Jerusalem has been the capital of Israel since 1948, when Israel was founded, and that all the institutions of the State of Israel, the Knesset, the Supreme Court, the foreign and domestic ministries, and so on, are on land that has always legally been part of Israel since the declaration of that state by the UN 67 years ago. Because of its inherent conservatism, post-World War II anti-Semitism, Arabism, and the weird and somewhat masochistic fear that Arab states will rise against American interests everywhere, the U.S. State Department has continued to pretend that Tel Aviv is the capital of Israel and that there's some question about whether people born in Jerusalem are actually born in Israel. While every single elected president in the past 30 years has sworn he will move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem when he's running for office, everyone has also welched on his election season commitment once he was president. Meanwhile, the State Department continues to insist that somebody born in Jerusalem was not born in Israel. Congress voted to change this law in 2002, 18 years ago. This is the bar mitzvah year for this law, but the State Department never followed it. It has been on the books all that time, and now the Supreme Court has agreed with the State Department. Justice Anthony Kennedy said in a majority opinion that the president has the exclusive power to recognize foreign nations, that the power to determine what a passport says is part of that. Recognition is a matter on which the nation must speak with one voice. Kennedy wrote, that voice is the president's. The ruling ends the lawsuit by a Jerusalem-born American, Menachem Zivotofsky, and his U.S. citizen parents. Justice Antonin Scalia read a summary of his dissent from the bench, saying the Constitution divides responsibility for foreign affairs between Congress and the president. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito joined the dissent. Justice Clarence Thomas agreed with the outcome of the case, but on narrower grounds. The justices had Zivotofsky's case before them once before. In 2012, the court rejected lower court decisions that called the matter a political issue that should be resolved by Congress and the president without the help of the courts. The federal appellate court in Washington then struck down the law as an unconstitutional intrusion by Congress on the president's authority over foreign affairs. There is even more history here. In 1995, Congress passed a law saying the U.S. should recognize a united Jerusalem as Israel's capital. In 2002, U.S. lawmakers passed new provisions urging the president to take steps to move the embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv and allowing Americans born in Jerusalem to have their place of birth listed as Israel. President George W. Bush signed those 2002 provisions into law, but noted U.S. policy regarding Jerusalem has not changed. Obama has taken the same, essentially hypocritical stance. That way, as president, you have your electoral cake and avoid having to come into conflict with the ultra-careful diplomats of your own State Department. And someone born in Jerusalem cannot have Israel as the birthplace on his or her U.S. passport, no matter how illogical that remains. In a follow-up to a painful story, leaders of the conservative Masoreti movement criticized Israeli President Reuven Rivlin's decision to host a joint bar mitzvah for physically disabled boys under the exclusive auspices of an Orthodox rabbi. The celebration was moved to the president's residence in Jerusalem after the mayor of Rehovot, back in April, canceled the bar mitzvah ceremony, scheduled in his town, because it would have been held in a Masoreti synagogue, a conservative synagogue in Rehovot. Rivlin said he would host the program under the auspices of both an Orthodox and a Masoreti rabbi. Wonderful. Last week, conservative movement leaders in Israel charged that at the last minute they were told that only an Orthodox rabbi would preside. It is painful to say it, but this is an act of cruelty in which disabled children and their parents are being denied a service that would help them. And the sole reason for this denial is the contempt of Israel's leaders for the sponsors of this program, the worldwide conservative Masoreti movement, the movement's leaders said in a letter sent to Rivlin last week. The signers included Rabbi Julie Schoenfeld, Executive Vice President of the Rabbinical Assembly, the Association of Conservative Masoreti Rabbis for the World, and Rabbi Steve Wernick, CEO of the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism, as well as Masoreti leaders in Israel and conservative leaders from around the world. Our love for the State of Israel is unconditional, but Israel must live up to her claims about herself, the letter said. Indeed.
And here it is! The 37-year wait is over! American Pharoah is finally the one! American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown!
And in happier news, most of the world knows that thoroughbred racehorse American Pharoah won the Racing Triple Crown last week and ended a 37-year drought since a firm beat Aludar in 1978. What they don't know is that the Egyptian-born owner of American Pharoah, Ahmed Zayat, is actually an Orthodox Jew and the son of President Anwar Sadat's personal physician. After developing an Egyptian beverage company into a successful organization that he sold to Heineken, Zayat has become one of the leading thoroughbred owners in the world. Although the once great Egyptian Jewish community has now dwindled to a handful of members, Zayat and his family were prominent members of that community. He now lives in New Jersey, where he and his family are active members of an Orthodox shul, keep kosher, and donate to Jewish charities. And so, mazel tov to Ahmed Zayat and his Triple Crown winning horse, American Pharoah. There is no word on whether American Pharoah was circumcised, although his tail is definitely shorter than you might expect. And that is the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. Well, you're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Randy Schoenberg is the attorney who led the fight to recover the famous Klimt painting dramatized in the film The Woman in Gold, which is an extraordinary film. I think everybody should see it. He also is the president of the Los Angeles Holocaust Museum, which has been created in recent years, and we'll talk about that as well. So let's talk about art restitution in general and the challenge that the Nazi kleptomania for excellent art has left for museums and countries all over Europe. When you started this project, you know, this couldn't have looked very promising.
Right. There obviously were many attempts to recover lost property, and including artwork since World War II. But by the time I came around in 1998, when Maria called me, most of the timelines had expired, statute of limitations, etc. But Austria, in 1998, passed a law saying that internally they would look through their museums, and if they found anything problematic, they would return it. And so that gave new hope to people like Maria Altman, who were still trying to recover some of their property. And so we started down that path, not knowing exactly where it would lead.
You know, they dramatized the struggle it was for you personally, and there's no greater crime in Los Angeles than driving a beat-up old car.
They changed it a little bit. I think I had a Mitsubishi at the time, but I like to keep my cars for about 10 years.
A wise financial decision. The award that ultimately came out was gigantic, and while the Klimt painting is a masterpiece and a very important piece, there probably are even more valuable works of art all over Europe where the provenance may not be so clear, or the survivors haven't come forward in exactly the right way to try to claim them.
I don't know about more valuable, because this painting was, at least for a time, the most valuable painting in the world, but there's certainly a lot of other property, including artworks and
buildings, you know, and all kinds
of... It's hard to put a number on it, because it's, you know, 6 million Jews were killed, and most of the property in Eastern Europe was never recovered. So it's only in Germany, Austria, France, Holland, some of the Western European countries where it's even possible. So, you know, leaving aside the millions and millions of things that people lost and that haven't been recovered in Eastern Europe, there's still lots of things even from Western Europe that have not been recovered. Just to give you an example, Maria Altman's brother-in-law, Bernard, who I mentioned earlier, who'd helped her and Fritz escape, his whole household was auctioned off just a few months after the Nazis came in, and they actually did a catalog with all the paintings, with pictures of them. So we had four paintings by a very famous artist from Venice named Canaletto. 70 years later, only one has been found. The other three, we have pictures of two of them, have not reappeared. So it just gives you an idea of the scope, just one artist. And there's a whole catalog, actually it's a two-book catalog of everything in his house that was taken. Almost all of it never recovered. So that's just one person, just to give you an idea that it's really almost bottomless, the number of things that still could be located and potentially recovered.
Why did it take so long? You know, in the last year, we saw a lot of attention paid to the art unit of the U.S. Army that recovered artworks, and they made George Clooney made a film about that. It's not only when we see films that we realize things are being brought to popular attention, but, you know, 50, 60, now 70 years after the art was stolen, and even after the end of World War II, things are now being kind of brought to mind.
You have to remember, after World War II, people had more important issues, yeah. Right? Life and death issues.
Sure.
So many people were killed. People who had escaped, you know, with their lives had to rebuild their lives, and so I think, you know, finding paintings and even family paintings or even valuable paintings wasn't the first thing on everybody's mind. Yes, the U.S. set up the Monuments Men. They did a great job recovering things, but they didn't do a good job returning things. So one of the reasons that we had this issue with the Bloch-Bauer family, Maria's family, is that the paintings from her uncle's collection that were taken by Hitler and Goering and for the planned Fuhrer Museum were recovered by the Monuments Men, but they couldn't actually pick them up from the Monuments Men in Munich. They had the Munich art collecting point. Rather, the Allies sent the paintings back to the country of origin, in this case Austria, and then they had to apply to the Austrian government for an export permit to get them back into their new homes, and that allowed Austria to essentially extort donations from Jewish families. Mm-hmm. That happened not just to Maria's family, but to the Austrian Rothschilds and dozens of other wealthy Jewish families, where they tried to recover property and take it out of Austria, and the Austrians said after the war, no, you have to leave it here, you have to give it to our museums if you want anything back. And that extortionate procedure is what was unwound by this new law in 1998, that it was designed to really reverse all those transactions. So the Monuments Men did a good job up to a point, but they did not do a good job of returning property. And just to give you another example, there are two paintings taken by Hermann Göring, the number two Nazi,
right,
and from a Dutch Jewish collector named Jacques Houtsteker. And these are paintings by Lucas Cranach, the elder, Adam and Eve pictures, if you ever watch Desperate Housewives. They're in the...
Gosh, you know, I have a litho of one of those in my house.
Right, so those are 100% looted, stolen paintings taken by Göring, not returned to the family. The original owner had died in a ship accident fleeing the country, and they, the Monuments Men sent those pictures back to Holland, and Dutch refused to return them to his widow and son, and they ultimately sold them to a Count Stroganov, who sold them to Norton Simon, who put them in the Norton Simon Museum, where they're hanging now. And there's been 8 years of litigation over those paintings trying to get them back. So, again, the Monuments Men did a great job up to a point, but not a good job in returning artwork to Jewish families.
You know, there have been a lot in the press over the last couple of years about a guy named Cornelius Gerlitt, which I'm sure you followed, the dealer for the Nazis and his son, who kept this enormous treasure trove of precious works, and now the German government is sort of enmeshed in that.
Yeah, he's passed away, and he left a will giving everything to a Swiss museum, and now they're figuring out what to do. I think a couple of paintings, they've announced some sort of settlement that they're going to be returned, but most of it is, but not all of it, has been put online. It took a few years for them to do that, and so now people are going through and trying to identify where these artworks came from and whether they should be returned. The problem is that European law is terrible for the recovery of artworks like this. So really there is no legal procedure in Germany or Switzerland or anywhere in Europe to recover artwork that you discover. If it comes to the United States, the law is different. It's sort of like a, if I can explain the legal regime, it's like a King Solomon situation. Sometimes you'll have a good faith purchaser who buys something that was stolen from someone else. And so you have two potential losers, right? Either the original owner or the person who bought it not knowing it was stolen. And the law has to pick one. It can't cut the baby in half. So the European model, it gives the artwork to the good faith purchaser. The American model gives the artwork back to the original owner. So sometimes you'll have artwork that you can't get when it's in Europe, but if it comes to the United States, if a court applies U.S. law, you can get it back. And so it's very, very complicated, but not easy to recover artworks in Europe. And matter of fact, I know of several paintings, even Klimt paintings, that are in private collections in Austria, and you can't get them back under Austrian law yet.
I think the movie dramatized, I don't know if it was accurate, but pretty well, realizing that if there was a way to bring things under American law, it would change the whole formula.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. There, like that case with the Cranach paintings, American law has been difficult. The other side has appealed twice to the Ninth Circuit. They've lost. The museum has lost. But it's delayed the case for about 8 years because the law is not 100% certain in many of these areas. And so, you know, it's getting better as the courts hear these cases and make decisions, but it's still very, very difficult in any jurisdiction to recover Nazi looted paintings.
So probably a naive legal question, but there are international courts. Is The Hague any possibility for trying to resolve some of these differences in international law?
That's generally for claims involving sort of country against country and
right,
international crimes and things. There's certain courts have been set up with certain limits to their jurisdiction, but individuals can't come to The Hague and ask for relief.
For relief. Kind of a different question. You used a part of the settlement to establish, to help establish the Los Angeles Holocaust Museum, of which you're the president. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust actually was established over 50 years ago. It's the oldest Holocaust Museum collection in the United States. and it was founded by survivors in Los Angeles. And I became president now in my 10th year, right before the Altman case ended. So I guess it was good karma. I took on the role, and then I won the case. And being in that position, then I was able to help. Wait,
by the way, Randy, we would say it's Beshert.
Beshert, exactly. A little more Jewish, right?
A little more Jewish.
Too Jewish. I was able to help complete an existing project to build a new building for Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust in Pan Pacific Park, which is next to the Grove and Farmers Market, if you know the L.A. Fairfax area there. And there had been an existing Holocaust monument, and so we built the museum around the monument in the park. And it's been terrific. It took a long time to finish it, but it's been open since 2010. I think we've had a 25% increase in attendance each of the last 2 years. So we're closing in on 50,000 people a year coming through the museum. And it's just been a great opportunity for me. I mean, it's the wrong word, but just sort of an incredibly beshert exam situation where I could take my success in the case for Maria Altman and turn that into a museum that's designed to teach people about the Holocaust. And my own family, as you mentioned earlier, is also involved in this story. My grandparents all fled the Nazis. My great-grandfather and many other relatives were murdered by the Nazis. And so I took a really active role in redesigning the museum with our existing collection, and I'm just very proud of it. I think it does a terrific job, and every day we get hundreds of people going through teaching them about the Holocaust. And, there is no greater crime in the history of mankind. There's no greater human tragedy than the Holocaust. It's not to brag, it's just a fact. And we're in this special time now where we still have survivors, and we have many of them who come and lecture at our museum. And we're able now to write the history of this important event that's going to be taught in schools for the next 500 years, 1,000 years, 2,000 years. This is an event, a world event in history that people are going to learn about, and we're in this special time now where we can assemble the documents, assemble the evidence, and put it in a presentable manner in a museum so that people can learn about it.
A final question. There's been a tremendous rise in anti-Semitism in the last few years in Europe. It almost feels like the kind of inoculation that the Holocaust created, in which anti-Semitism was still there but kind of went underground. It's now come out. It's a different kind of anti-Semitism in places led by Muslims, but it must be difficult to watch that, knowing how difficult it was even for you to deal with the Austrian government.
Yes, there's this line in the movies where my character says, there are two Austrias. There's one that really wants to do the right thing and supports restitution. There's the other that just doesn't. And that's been my experience. That's something I actually wrote. And so there are people who are very good in Europe. And I think, if you've been there, other people have been there, you can meet just the most wonderful people who recognize the terrible tragedy in the past and want to make things right. And then you meet people who, you just have this feeling, if the war had ended differently and the Nazis had won, they'd be perfectly happy. And, that's not a luxury any Jew can have. But it does exist. And so it's obviously disconcerting to see all the anti-Semitism and the attacks, especially in France and Belgium, from the last year. On the other hand, I read stories of the real growth in Jewish life in Berlin, for example.
Right.
The influx of Israelis coming there, and I went to Vienna and just was, a very nice Jewish community there. So I think there's signs for hope and signs for concern, and we just have to work with both of them.
I want to thank Randy Schoenberg for a great visit here on Too Jewish. By the way, the movie The Woman in Gold is still out some places, and I'm sure it'll be available lots of other places. Where can people go to find out more about the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust?
There's a website, lamoth.org, so LA Museum of the Holocaust, lamoth.org, and you can learn all about our museum. It's in Pan Pacific Park, and I hope everybody comes to visit.
Where I used to go to the Israel Festival a million years ago as a kid. Thanks again, and all the best.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Professor Sarah Benor of Hebrew Union College, a sociologist analyzing Jewish camps, the Pew Report, the Baal Tshuva movement, and much more. Our playout this morning comes from the great Israeli-Moroccan singer Yehoram Gaon. It's the classic song Yesh Makom, There Is a Place. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Yesh makom rachok achrei hayam, sham hachol lavan habayit cham, sham hashemesh meira me'am.